You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Tuesday, 23 April. We've got Capitec results due within the hour. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb studios in Gauteng, Johannesburg. On the show today, Kieran Whitten from Anchor. US reporting season, we're going to chat on Netflix and ASML. We're chatting with Simon Fillmore from Independent Securities. They are very much liking Chinese investments right now. And then KPMG have got their inaugural Southern African Banking Survey. We'll dig into that around opportunities into the rest of the continent. This show is brought to you by Stanlib. Visit stanlib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. Morning headlines for MoneyWeb. Some asset managers still have room for 100% offshore funds. Remember last week we mentioned that there was capping at 45%, but some of the large investment houses with the bigger balance sheets have spare capacity. Business Day, Eli suspends trade of its stock on the JSE, says it's unable to comply with listing requirements. I don't know why it wasn't suspended a while ago. It is in liquidation. Morning markets, US was green, S&P up 0.9%, NASDAQ up 1%. Over in the East, also green. Sydney, 0.25% higher. Tokyo, 0.25% up. Hong Kong, 1.6%. And Tencent, 2.5% higher. Commodities mostly red. Gold, $2,320 an ounce. Brent is green at $87.40. Platinum, $923. Palladium, $1,006. Rand is $19.20. Bitcoin, $66,700. Top 40 opening call, green open, 170 points or 0.25% higher.
MoneyWeb Now, on the money. Also available on podcast.
Trading now with Kieran Whitten from Anchor. Kieran, appreciate the early morning time. As I said in the intro, results starting to flow coming out of the US. Netflix, really strong numbers coming out of them. Subscriber growth looking really, really good. Although they do mention that starting next year, they won't give subscriber numbers. But all in all, a good looking set of numbers from Netflix.
Good morning, Simon. And yeah, it's earnings season in the US is in full swing now. And as you've said, results in subscriber growth, I think once again surpassed expectations. They've actually now had quite a few strong quarters. But this quarter really was a blowout quarter, very positive on all the main metrics. But the main news that the market has focused on is that they are no longer going to report subscriber numbers starting from next year. And this, I think, largely was the most important metric in their growth story up to now. And I think how the market is now perceiving this is that the subscriber growth story could now be over. Management, on the other hand, are saying that they are changing their revenue and business model, and the focus is now shifting to advertising. And interestingly, 40% of all new subscribers are actually taking the subscription that does have ads in. So I think advertisers are going to start lining up to display content on Netflix. And the reality for you and me, because there's going to be more, there's going to be differing levels of subscription accounts. Yeah. I think that streaming is going to become more expensive. But I think as well, Netflix remains in a strong financial position. They really are solidifying themselves as the market leader. They continue to generate a lot of free cash flow, whilst the competitors, to be honest, are still struggling to make positive free cash flows on their streaming businesses. And Simon, my takeaway from the results is something I think that we've come to learn now, is that the share price reaction after the results is actually more about the outlook than the financial results themselves. Because, I mean, like we've said, the results were strong. Mm. But the outlook, the market now just starting to question the growth story again due to this change of reporting.
Yeah, but I take your point, and I think the key point, perhaps, as you say, like no one else is at that really doing half as well. I mean, I think of Disney Plus, who really should be ahead of the curve, but I mean, Netflix is eating everyone's lunch. ASML, a Dutch company, they really are, in many senses, the shovel makers in the AI boom. And another little stock. I mean, everyone looks at Nvidia and the like, but these guys are doing excellent as well.
No, exactly, Simon. I actually love that analogy, the shovel sellers in the AI race. And I think to really understand the importance of ASML, you need to start with the basics, and that chips are used all around the world in phones, computers, cars, and the like. And our dependence on chips is going to keep on growing going forward. So now, how does ASML make their money? They make their money selling very expensive lithography machines to chip manufacturers. And they actually have a monopoly in some sense on these machines around the world. And so it's a very, very highly specialized company with a very wide moat. So it is the sort of company we at Anchor do like to invest in. But another key feature of the chip industry is that it is highly cyclical as it is leveraged to consumer spending. And there was a downturn after the COVID boom. And ASML's results are showing that this downturn is actually persisting for a bit longer. Their orders missed a bit. Mm-hmm. But I think, again, if we focus now on the outlook rather than the actual results, the short-term outlook is definitely recovering. And the long-term positive megatrends remain in place for a company like ASML. The chip industry is expected to double in size over the next decade. And ASML is in position A to capitalize on that. And in the shorter term, geopolitics is a bit of an issue in this sector. So there's new fabrication plants being built all around the world. And these will pretty much all require ASML's machines. And like you've said, it's often a forgotten stock, but it's a very strong performer, up 800% over the last 8 years. And I think, you know, it did get too expensive. You'll see it sold off a bit after results,
yeah.
But it's the kind of company that we're happy to have some exposure through, or exposure to, all through the cycles.
We'll leave it there. That's Kieran Whitten from Anchor. Kieran, appreciate the early morning.
Your money gives a damn. If it could protest and sign petitions, your money would. But your money can do more than that. When you invest in Stanlib's infrastructure investment fund, beyond getting solid returns, you are helping to build a more sustainable future through job creation and positive economic growth. Damn right you are. Invest for more impact at stanlib.com/more. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider.
MoneyWeb now on the money.
I'm chatting with Simon Fumo, Chief Investment Officer at Independent Securities. Simon, appreciate the time today. From a sort of big picture macroeconomic perspective, the Chinese slowdown can actually be viewed in positive light because so much of that growth over the last couple of decades has been around sort of debt and housing spending and the like, which I suppose grows an economy, but sort of cutting back on that's not the worst.
Yes, exactly. And I think it's very good to purge past excesses, and often economies need to take their medicine, and the quicker you can take your medicine, the quicker you recover. And certainly we saw that in the global financial crisis around 15, 16 years ago, where the US banks took their medicine very quickly and the recovery was in with 18 months. You know, contrast that to Japan, where the government bolstered up those banks for a significant period of time, and it's only recently those stock markets have surpassed those highs because it took them a long time to actually adjust their asset values for the excesses of the past. So I think China's on a good path in that regard, and the slowdown is good because it'll lead to more efficient capital allocation going forward.
And that then ties in. I mean, particularly, everyone thought that the zero COVID policy being lifted was going to be significant. It was in some ways, but the big bank stimulus that a lot were expecting hasn't come. And that again, perhaps, is the Chinese sort of Xi Jinping kind of trying to be responsible and almost change tack in China, internal growth rather than debt fueled.
Yeah, and I think we've all been disappointed by the rally that we all thought would transpire after COVID. Restrictions were dropped, and that certainly hasn't happened, and the economies continue to remain restrained, and we see that reflected in the stock market, where the Hang Seng index is down 40% over the last 3 years. And I was actually just looking in terms of historical context where the Hang Seng is now trading, and it's trading at the same level as it was 27 years ago. So certainly valuations and prices are quite depressed. I think historically, investors have always relied on some sort of big bank stimulus measure from the Chinese government, as we saw in 2016 and towards the end of the global financial crisis. And this time around, we haven't seen those sorts of measures. And I think it has disappointed investors. But I think what we've seen are far more subtle signs from the government, specifically in terms of trying to get the stock market to move higher. And specifically, we've seen the Chinese Sovereign Wealth Fund starting to buy domestic ETFs. The Chinese Security Regulatory Commission has encouraged institutional investors to participate in the stock market with greater effort. And usually when there's a directive from the CCP, it is adhered to by all the other regulatory bodies that sit below it, and of course, corporates. And then we've also seen things like stamp duty halving, margin requirements have also been reduced, and insurance regulators have reduced the risk weighting of stocks when assessing companies' capital adequacy requirements. So all of those point to a stimulatory, or the government trying to stimulate the economy, I think because they realize the positive wealth effect that it can have. And of course, if you have a rising stock market, it increases confidence, which causes people to spend more money, which creates higher employment, which leads to improved productivity, and of course leads to higher GDP growth. We also saw, you know, once again, going back to the great financial crisis, the impact of that on the US and the wealth that was created in the US post the global financial crisis. So I think in a manner of speaking, the Chinese regulators are trying to do something similar.
And what we've got, and you mentioned the Hang Seng, if we look at Chinese stocks and the note you put out, Tencent, Alibaba, JD.com, and we compare the valuations on those Chinese tech stocks, which are, you know, global leaders in their own right, we compare that against the US. I mean, it's chalk and cheese. The US stocks are anything between expensive and eye-wateringly expensive, and these are eye-wateringly cheap in many cases.
Yeah, and they're exceptionally cheap. And we've made the point that, you know, we haven't seen valuations this cheap in 20, 25 years. And certainly there should be some discount to Chinese shares just because of the high risk that comes with them. But all the bad news that you can imagine in Chinese shares. And one of the things that we're increasingly seeing is that they have very high cash balances, specifically when compared to their market cap. So if you look at something like Alibaba, it has 35% of its market cap represented by net cash on its balance sheet. Baidu is about 50% of net cash as a percentage of its market cap. And JD.com is almost 80%. Wow. So in anyone's language, those are very cheap valuations. And if you start backing that cash out of the market cap, you get to either low or negative PE multiples.
And the other perhaps final piece in the puzzle is household cash balances, which in the note you put out has increased significantly over the last four or so years.
Exactly. And I think that's another piece of the story is that Chinese households have become very conservative. And I alluded earlier on to the Chinese government trying to get this wealth effect going. And it essentially is to get households to move their cash balances, which have gone up 65% to $7.4 trillion over the last couple of years, because they were hit so hard during COVID and the lockdowns were severe. So the Chinese are quite different to the rest of the world, where they've historically predominantly invested in either real estate or cash. So at the moment, 70% of Chinese savings are in real estate, with the balance being in cash or equities, but equities are a much smaller component. So if there is any structural change in that relationship, it could result in a meaningful flow of cash going into the stock market, which would be very good for those depressed valuations. And of course, at the same time, although China is the world's second biggest economy, by no means does it represent the second biggest country in global investors' portfolios. Most global investors are significantly underweight Chinese equities.
And if those private citizens start spending, it's back to that cycle you mentioned in terms of investors feel wealthy, it gives them some confidence, they spend, the valuations go up. We'll leave it there. Simon Fulmer, Chief Investment Officer, Independent Securities. Appreciate the time.
And that's our poll today, LinkedIn and Twitter. Chatting with Simon there. Are you bullish on Chinese stocks? I mean, he makes a great point around, you know, they're never going to get the sort of valuations perhaps around that you see in US tech stocks. But certainly, I mean, JD.com, 80% of market cap is in cash. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter.
Your money can do more when it's investing with conviction. Our partnership with JP Morgan Asset Management gives you access to in-depth, broad market research and high-return investment strategies. So invest in a select set of companies with long-term structural growth potential with StanLib's Global Growth Fund. Seek more returns at stanlib.com/more. StanLib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
Chatting now with Auguste Claude Nglusop. He's partner and head of banking advisory at KPMG in Southern Africa. We're talking the inaugural Southern African Banking Survey coming out from KPMG. Auguste, appreciate the early morning. Banking in Africa is fairly strong across the continent, but it still offers great growth opportunity. And your inaugural survey says particularly in corporate and investment banking.
Morning, Simon. Thank you for having me and morning to your listeners. Indeed, yes, banking in Africa, we survey our largest clients locally and also in the regions about the plan to grow across the continent. And definitely, corporate investment banking came out on top, alongside your traditional banking. And so we also found that although retail is always sometimes mentioned, it wasn't really because we're looking here over the next 6-7 years, what will be driving the growth across the continent, yes.
And is this African banks rather than European or American banks who are operating on the continent, or do we have a strong sort of homegrown continental banks?
We're talking here mostly about Africans, Pan-African banks, African banks, our standard banks, your APSA, your UBA in Nigeria, and all your Moroccan banks. So it's really mostly African banks growing outside of the core markets across the continent. What we've seen over the last 6-7 years is European banks actually leaving the continent. Yeah. Remember, Barclays leaving a few years ago. We've seen Standard Chartered reducing their presence. We see the French bank leaving as well for various reasons. So this is really opportunities that are for homegrown African banks to really benefit from this massive opportunity we're seeing in the banking sector.
I take your point on that. Well, one of the challenges cited is regulatory environment. And I imagine it's probably one of those things where some markets have perhaps got stronger regulatory environment, others less so. And it's kind of almost getting those to the same high standard to make operating across a market that much easier.
Sure, Simon. I think we in the SADC, we are quite fortunate to have markets which are quite, I would say, more harmonized. You look at South Africa, you look at Namibia, Botswana, even Mauritius, you have standards which are quite common. When you move beyond that, you move into the rest of the continent, you start having regulatory framework which are quite different. And this is a key challenge, right? To get it right. When you get it right, actually, it's easier to operate across border comfortably and not having to get into every market and rethink completely how to operate, to relearn completely the rules that are governing those markets. And we're seeing entities like the World Bank, the African Development Bank, and all those DFIs, helping to harmonize, framework across countries because they're quite influential in some African countries. So that is something that we will see that, converging over the next 5-10 years. And until then, you will still have a lot of fly-in, fly-out banking approach. You still have a lot of banks be quite scared to actually put foot on the ground. We're seeing places like Kenya growing very well, in the banking sector. And we have, of course, our Stanbic there, our APSA. But in other parts of the continent, I'm thinking about Ethiopia, which is a fantastic market for the future. There's going to be wait and see until you have convergence around that framework to move forward. Yes.
Take your point. I want to quickly come back to retail. You said that the retail space is perhaps not offering as good a potential as the corporate, the investment banking. But one of the stories around retail is payments, where kind of in Africa we lead the way. We in many cases lead the developed economies. But this is perhaps more fintech startups than it is traditional banks.
I think the payment story in Africa has been something quite well discussed. And I think the reason also is that the telco came to the payment space as well to help, around infrastructure around this. Of course, the fintech came in there as well. And the banks also are there, helping, plumbing the infrastructure around payment. So what we're saying that, or what the survey shows is that retail, of course, is good. It's there to stay. It's a mass market. This is where the most unbanked population on the continent are. So we see that as a future element of growth. However, today, if you look at most banks' profitability, you know, where the big bucks are coming from now are corporate investment banking, are transaction banking, are trade finance, and all those activities which are slightly away from retail. But just to be very careful as well, yeah. Now, retail is definitely a key important sector, and all the telco we're seeing, all the fintech we're seeing, all the digital banks that are coming on. I mean, we saw Old Mutual getting the license this week. So we're seeing all those new banks are going to be targeting primarily the retail sector locally, mm-hmm. and also outside of the continent.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, the telcos. M-Pesa came out in 2007, if memory serves.
Exactly.
So way ahead of some of the fintech that we're seeing. We'll leave it there. That's Augusto Claude Ngusop. He's partner and head of banking advisory at KPMG in Southern Africa. Appreciate the early morning. That's it for today. We're chatting with Isaac Odendahl from Old Mutual Wealth Investment Strategist. Central banks, can they cut ahead of the Federal Reserve? Most and more importantly for us, can the SARB cut before the Fed? Almost half said nope, they'll have to wait. The rest was split between yes, they can, and the others saying please just cut already. Have your vote, have your say, LinkedIn and Twitter. The show is brought to you by StanLib. Visit StanLib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. StanLib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. We're live every weekday morning, the MoneyWeb website and the app, 6:30 a.m. podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nubuchle, Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow. Equities in 2024.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now. On the money.